Bueller's intricate spacing and stage pictures. You have to be both a harsh critic and strong advocate for yourself. There are tremendous advantages to being able to get some perspective on your work. It's tough, but you have to find the objectivity to look at your work and become the teacher, the coach, the mentor for yourself when the moment arises. I didn't make it past 10 minutes of that tape. I shut the thing off the moment it became clear to me what my work needed to be in the two-week rehearsal process before our Broadway opening. In the off-Broadway run, I'd been so focused on the emotional journey and the more technical demands of Lynn's score that I hadn't made strong enough physical choices for Burr. I had barely landed on any. I didn't have much time to add the crucial element, but I couldn't move forward without drilling down on this piece of the performance I'd all but ignored. I approached John Rua, one of the extraordinary movement specialists in our ensemble, and asked if he could find time during the few off hours we had to help me make stronger choices and take the performance to the next level. John and I worked with a camera in our sessions. He helped me create the beginnings of a movement vocabulary for Burr. We talked about how to better use, fill, and inhabit the space. I'll always be grateful that John was willing to take the time. The result was a more fully realized and three-dimensional performance uptown. When I was at my best, it was a full-bodied investment in the evening's proceedings, pinky toes to hair follicles. The work isn't over until it's over. You either fine-tune and keep making it better until they rip the pencil from your hand, or once you intuit that you've finished and that you've conveyed what you intended to convey in your work, you put your own pencil down, step back, and triple-check. We kept the things that worked. We jettisoned the things that didn't. The off-Broadway to Broadway transfer was all about the edit. We had the time to make it better. We had the time to release the grip on something that really worked and grab a hold of something that could really, really work. And this was the group of people crazy enough to try. Everything about the external world changed for us after Hamilton opened on Broadway. History was cool. Broadway was mainstream. People cared about who we were and what we had to say. It was all new. Where it gets tricky is how you allow those external changes to affect you on the inside. Success can change who you are so easily, especially if you don't already know who you are. I am grateful that I'd lived some life and spent a little time in the wilderness before Burr found me. Tommy Kale, our director, went to great lengths to preserve the sanctity of the workspace. Early on, he gathered us together. I can't control what happens outside of here. I know how noisy it is for all of you. We were only just getting started, and the distractions were many and extreme. Inside this theater, Tommy went on, let this be our sanctuary. In here, we just get to do our show. Tommy helped us preserve and protect the magic of Hamilton, making sure the theater remained a holy space, assuring that in the eye of that hurricane, we could always find quiet. For me, Hamilton was my first real brush with the American dream. I'd gone to Hollywood a decade earlier in search of it. All these years later, I could see that every triumph and every failure, every lesson learned along the way, was available for me to access and use to ensure that I made the most out of this moment. A Broadway musical about the Founding Fathers, a piece of art in part about slave owners and their American Revolution, bought me freedom. The American dream had a new spirit and a new context for me now. Lin-Manuel, David Diggs, Chris Jackson, and all my brothers and sisters at the Rogers had given the dream a new face. Hamilton tapped into what theater can do on its highest level. Lin-Manuel understands how to musicalize the highs and lows of the human experience. Hamilton is human rites of passage set to music. In the span of the musical, we essentially cover childhood, abandonment, adolescence, loneliness, bravery and valor, war, falling in love, getting married, having children, jealousy and envy, betrayal, death, loss, and ultimately, redemption. When you get to the end of the show, there is so much life the audience has gotten to live together. Together with the storytellers on stage, there is so much ground you've covered, you can't help but feel connected. It opens you up for catharsis, for that spontaneous rush of emotion. And isn't that what our love affair with the theater is about? It is about catharsis. We go into a darkened theater to sit next to strangers and feel something. On Broadway, actors have their day off so that at night, they can come to the theater and do on stage what we are afraid to do, what we are not emotionally equipped to do, or what we aren't allowed to do in our everyday lives. Actors are our avatars. They are our stand-ins. When a performer stands on stage and bares her soul, she bares her soul for all of us. When a man stands on stage and lets his heart break, he lets his heart break for all of us. There is an invitation to participate, but we are also free to observe and learn. We elect them to do us this service, our theater stars and our movie stars. The same is true of the great singers, right? We elect them. I'm thinking of Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson and Barbara Streisand and Tina Turner, Bruce Springsteen, Jay-Z, Kanye, Nina Simone. They don't just sing for us, they sing for us. Bruce is the voice of a generation. Jay-Z is the voice of a generation. Marvin is the voice of a generation. They are the chosen representative of a group of people. If you're ever curious to know who an artist is, you get to know who their fan base is. Get to know the people they sing for. Art has to occupy a space of significance in civilized society. We translate the vitality of the human experience through the art our society produces. We translate the pain and discord, the joy and sadness and majesty, all of it through our art. I think Hamilton did this. It is, at once, one of the easiest and hardest things you can set out to do. Lin set out to do it with his pen. He recruited a room full of people willing to carry that vision from the page to the stage. We gave Hamilton back to New York City on August the 6th, 2015. They gave us their open hearts and the whole world in return. In the spring of 2016, after over 400 performances of Hamilton the Musical in New York City, the Tony Award nominations were announced. The award season in general can be a heady time. We've been through it in part once before with the Off-Broadway run. There are best performance of the season lists that you're included on and some you are not. Once the award season begins, you can't help but have it in your periphery, but you do well not to make it your main focus. I was hopeful for the Tony nomination for sure, but in all honesty, I had come so far with Hamilton that I didn't want the nomination or lack thereof to blight this blessing for me in any way. I knew nothing was owed to me in that moment. I remained hopeful, but not expectant, and I tried not to lose sight of the fact that the whole thing was fleeting. The morning of the nominations announcement, Nicolette and I cut our phones off, and went to our favorite New York diner for breakfast. We ordered pancakes and waffles, and we locked in a memory of how good life was in that moment. Sitting at a diner with zero Tony nominations between us and the best pancakes and waffles in New York City. If life was to remain this way for a little while longer or forever, we were going to be okay. On the walk home from breakfast, we turned our phones on and full voicemail inboxes and text message after text message let us know that there was cause for celebration. Not just for me, but for so many of my castmates. Hamilton had received a record-breaking number of Tony nominations with individual nods for me, Lynn, Philippa, David, Renee, Chris, and Jonathan Groff, our King George III. The awards were to be given out on June the 11th, 2016, at the Beacon Theater. The weeks leading up were about savoring and letting go. They were about celebrating what all the preparation and sacrifice had brought to us, and they were about letting go of any expectations for the night of the 11th. They were about savoring the fact that we got to have this victory lap as a little family, which is what the cast had become by then, and they were about preparing to say goodbye to Hamilton and Burr and make space in my life for whatever adventure would be next. I couldn't hold on to Burr forever. My year-long commitment would end at the top of July, and I knew there would be many, many more talented, underused, and creatively starved men after me who would come for their own revolution on the stage at the Rogers. I remember when I arrived at the Nederlander Theater to begin my Rent adventure. Most of the original cast members were long gone, but their powerful intention, their love, the spell they'd cast, was everywhere you looked. They were still there. Jonathan was still there. Those of us who came behind them ate and drank at the table they set. As I prepared to exit stage right in a few weeks for the last time, it felt like we'd cast the spell as a company. It felt like we'd done our part to make this an equitable, welcoming, and wonderful place to work for what would hopefully be years and years to come. At the time, the night of the Tony Awards was rivaled in excitement only by our wedding day. Nicolette and I arrived at the Beacon Theater, dizzy and electrified. We were so happy to be there. Now, lots of people will tell you they've been practicing their acceptance speech since they were a kid, in the mirror, with the hairbrush. I get it. People asked me if I was that kid, and truthfully, I was not that kid. I've never practiced my acceptance speech. What I have practiced since I was a kid, and my mother made me write notes of gratitude whenever someone did something kind for me, when Mrs. Turner asked me to write what was most important to me and assured me that people would care, when they gave my grandfather a year to live, is the love and care you put into saying thank you whenever you're given the chance. Time is not promised. Say thank you in exactly the way you intend to when the moment arrives. That was the thing I was most grateful for that night. There were so many people who'd encouraged and inspired and carried me all the miles to the podium on the night of the Tony Awards. When my name was called, my only job was to mention as many of them as I could and to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. Simple. Gratitude has a drawing power all its own, and nothing can keep you from making it a daily practice. I left the Richard Rogers Theater weeks later with a tired body, a full heart, friends for life, the prefix Tony and Grammy Award winner to my name, the richness of these memories, and a tremendous sense of pride. As a body of strangers, over the course of some time together, we'd touched greatness. And in our finest hour as practitioners, we'd been present, we'd been vulnerable, we'd been kind, we'd made something that mattered. The willingness to fail led us here. The willingness to risk led us here. Love and trust led us here. I was a witness, and I will carry the experience and the gratitude with me always. Chapter 9, Permission to Prosper. Don't count the days. Make the days count. Muhammad Ali. It's 9 p.m. on a Thursday night in October 2017, and I've just made my way into the boxing gym where I train as many days in the week as my schedule allows. For whatever reason, the gym's unusually quiet for this time of night. As I wrap my hands and tug on the gloves to get ready to hit the big bag, I have to laugh at how few people who know me well could have predicted that I'd take so wholeheartedly to boxing. Sure, I'm somewhat competitive when it comes to working out, but I've never been intensely involved with any particular sport. So why boxing? For starters, keeping off the pounds is a lot harder with the absence of the 3-hour cardio bomb I used to get 8 times a week. I've had to intensify my workouts just to maintain. Experienced fighters will tell you about the mind-body-soul integration of a great session in the gym. I am discovering all of this for the first time. Boxing is this stripped-down, primal experience that can be almost meditative. Gabe, my coach, is part Jedi, part yogi. My favorite repeated refrain from Gabe comes whenever I'm in bad form or when some fundamental he's repeatedly shown me isn't clicking once again. Gabe reminds me, "Les, relax your shoulders." 9 times out of 10, it's all I need to hear to get me back on track. I go through my days now, hearing the simple reminder from my middleweight urban sensei. I'm often surprised at how the simple self-correction can help root me in the present. Tension evaporates from my jaw and my chest. I am free to do my best. I am out of my own way. The relaxation brings old and new lessons into focus. Focus has sharpened with some time and distance between me and the comet. There should probably be a 12-step program. Hamilton, the Broadway musical, was a hard habit to kick. It took me about a year to sober up completely after the trip. I walked around in a stupor for a while, here but not here. In time, I felt ready to commit to starting something new. In time, I felt I could do so without feeling the need to compare and measure new projects against the phenomenon. In time, I was able to be on my new ish, and it felt right. The Hamilton logo is fitting. Hitching my wagon to that glorious star paid off beyond anything I could have dreamed. But eventually, it was time to hitch my wagon to my own star. As circumstances and situations from the past had shown me the importance of giving myself the permission to fail, this time around, it would be about giving myself the permission to succeed. In the days and months after the show, I put most of my energy toward creative independence. I knew that music was the thing I could do if and when the phone ever stopped ringing. I used whatever goodwill I'd garnered from my time on stage, whatever chip the success of the show had given me, to get a band of brilliant musicians together and get to work. A week after my final performance, the fellas and I began a 3-week residency at a club downtown. There are 6 of us, including me, 5 pieces and a vocalist. In a week, I'd gone from 1,300 screaming and devoted fans at the Richard Rogers as part of the Hamilton Ensemble to 125 very, very polite people in a tiny room in downtown New York City as a solo artist. Even so, I loved the intimacy of connecting with a much smaller audience. I loved the creative control and the freedom of expression. with new dreams of the Kennedy Center and Carnegie Hall, Madison Square Garden and the Hollywood Bowl. We filled the calendar with dates around the country. We practiced. We recorded two LPs and saw them both reach number one on the Billboard jazz charts. Failures along the way have been a teacher and pushed us forward, and we toast the hard-won incremental successes whenever they grace us. We were and are most certainly on our way. Burr's credo was to wait for the moment, the open door, the invitation. In Hamilton, Burr spends years waiting for a chair to be offered at the table in the room where it happens. Patience and timing will play a part in your ultimate success for sure. But I found the happiness and the consistency I wanted for so long at the exact moment I decided to build my own table and my own chairs. No one has to give you permission to be entrepreneurial in creating opportunities for yourself. You don't have to wait to cast yourself in the starring role in your narrative and then take action on your own behalf. With vision and leadership, you'll attract a team of empowered supporters and advisors. Their success will be inspired by yours. Giving yourself permission to prosper will also challenge you to know your worth, especially when negotiating on your own behalf and asking for what is fair. This doesn't mean you have to become overly money-driven or attach numerical values to your dreams. What it does mean is that as you prepare to enter or elevate yourself in your chosen field, the more financially literate you become, the better you'll be able to pave the way for your own prosperity. Permission to prosper also asks you to define what success looks like to you. It looks different to each of us. The more clearly defined, the easier it'll be to recognize when it shows up. I've seen an expansion in my dream life. Who I dream of and who I dream for expanded the day Nicolette and I welcomed our Lucille in the early spring of 2017. Lucille Ruby was born in Santa Monica, California, in the small hours of April 23rd. Nicolette labored quickly, with tremendous courage and a determination I hadn't yet seen before in my small-framed, sweet wife. Even the nurses were impressed. Nicolette was extraordinary, as was the tiny light we welcomed to the world that Sunday morning. We named her Lucille after her maternal great-grandmother, a woman who wisely fled Vienna, Austria to America in advance of the most unspeakable horrors of World War II. Early in our relationship, while working in Europe, Nicolette and I made a trip to visit Litzy's childhood home. Lucille Baum was a woman with an irrepressible spirit, kind eyes, and a will as strong as steel. Ruby is also a family name. It belonged to my mother's great aunt. In old family pictures, she's a woman with great style and a killer smile. But Nick and I figured there could be no harm in connecting our little light to iconoclastic Rubies like Bridges and Dee, even if solely in name. Your name speaks before you do. In a way, it's your first compass upon arrival. It says something to you and to the world about the dream your parents cast on your behalf and the wish they made for you at the start. I dream for Lucille just as my father dreamed for me. I was around 12 years old when my father gave me the nickname Sammy in tribute of another junior, Sammy Davis, a nickname that was Dad's subtle way of telling me he believed in me. Dad's present to me on the night of my Broadway debut in Rent was a teddy bear wearing a customized sash that read, "Good luck, Sammy. Break a leg." Through the course of writing this book, I've gained new insight into Dad's strengths as a parent and gotten more clarity about where he might have fallen short. Mom taught me to love by loving me unconditionally. And early on, long before I was aware of it, Dad had cast a vision for me, his namesake, that was limitless. He handed down the affectionate nickname of a legend and a triple threat who, in the course of his life and unparalleled career in entertainment, removed all labels and gave himself permission to write his own story and his own ticket. The nickname was Dad sending a message to me that he thought maybe I could do the same. He didn't harp on it. He let me fill in the blanks. There is something powerful about what a parent dreams for their child. It doesn't always end up as the parent intends, but the dream itself, the vision you hold for your kid until the day they can hold it for themselves, is so important. I know that Lucille's experience in the world is not mine. Where she'll go and what she'll see will probably have little resemblance to where I've been and what I've seen. Even so, I am actively dreaming a dream for her, holding a vision and a space for the kind of woman I hope she grows up to be. Her mother dreams alongside me. We grow the dream with each passing day. We dream in size and in technicolor of the influence Lucille and the young women of her generation will wield in this world. They will leave their mark. The world will make room for them. And when they don't, our girls will unite and continue to make room for themselves. I am in no rush, but the day will surely come when we will hand over the dreams and visions we fostered for our sweet Lucille. Eventually, we will hand them over to the young woman herself. This, too, will be part of her inheritance. She will edit, reshape, and reimagine the dream as her Taurus heart demands. Our job is only to make them wild enough and large enough that she may spend her hours and her years in joyful pursuit. Who are you dreaming for today? When you allow yourself to visualize your own possibilities, it is amazing how clearly and how fully they can be manifested. A decisive change on the inside of you will eventually undoubtedly change the world around you. I wish I could have shown the guy on the couch 6 or 7 years ago what his life was going to look like the second he got off that couch and into action. Every single day, I can strive for more clarity and specificity of my vision. And every single day, I can take a single step towards seeing that vision manifest. There has been a steady wind at my back since being off the couch. When I prayed for guidance or asked for it from friends, I have been aided and encouraged. Whenever I've taken my one step, the universe has always helped me take two. I believe the same will be true for you. I am rooting for you and your rise. Give yourself the permission to prosper today. Relax your shoulders. Begin. Epilogue. Seriously. I will not allow one prejudiced person, or 1 million, or 100 million, to blight my life. My inner life is mine, and I shall defend and maintain its integrity against all the powers of hell. James Weldon Johnson. In the years since the night I stood on stage at the Richard Rogers and wondered how, in the time that's passed since the walk home on which I conceived of our conversation, what has continued to elude me has been balance. I get a handle on it, and 2 months later, I'm facing something or someone that I've been neglecting, and I have to do my best to get a handle on it once more. I've been intentional in those times and successfully pulled through, but relationships fray with the jostling. They are delicate things. Families fracture. Home is the one place I do not want to face the effects of failure. So we search for the solutions. We fold in the ones we like best, and we press on. Almost home now. I am desperate to finish my tiny book. I promised to write it. I said I would get it done in the time they allotted. It's not a big book, but the time commitment and investment has been total. I want to put the final punctuation mark and my pencil down as fast as I can, but I feel as if there is one more thing I need to say. It has yet to be said in these pages, and it is the necessary counterweight to inspirational speak about achievement and possibility. So, in the service of balance. A commitment to failing up does not trump systemic and institutional racism. When looking at the tasks we have before us as citizens, we must handle our most troubling societal ills with the seriousness they deserve. The more serious the sickness, the less likely you are to find the cure over the counter. A commitment to risk or to failure in the spectacular is not an override key for sexism or homophobia or transphobia. Only our commitment to citizenship can do that. And compassion. A collective commitment to compassion could do it. 6 years ago, my mentor challenged me not to quit on myself and fail through inaction, but to try. Facing threats to the future of our democracy, we can't afford to fail through inaction. We have to try. In the fall of 17, I arrived in Charlottesville, Virginia, to perform at the University of Virginia's bicentennial celebration. It had been mere weeks since UVA was chosen as the site for a racist white nationalist rally. Images and video from the hate-filled, violent, tiki torch march were everywhere, and a town and a university's reputation had been blighted collaterally. 22,000 alumni and longtime supporters were also scheduled to descend onto the campus in celebration. There was no ignoring it once we arrived. In a Q&A session with theater and other fine arts majors, a student raised her hand to jumpstart the afternoon. The first question of the day was, in light of recent events here, Lil Yachty canceled a planned Charlottesville visit and concert. Future canceled his visit and his show. Why didn't you? Why didn't you cancel? The first question, what are you doing here? Well, I can leave if you want me to, I told her, but I hope you'll let me stay for a bit. She laughed. We all did. But I knew what she was getting at. I went on to tell her that there was no place I would rather be. I wish I could have been here during the rally, too, to be honest. Because we have been told for years that this type of hatred, this particular brand of divisiveness, this kind of sickness was a thing of the past in America, though we could feel otherwise. You want to believe it. You would be a fool to believe it. The images coming out of Charlottesville told a different story. Exit polls at the ballot box tell a very different story. Woefully, it is the same old story, actually. To stare down the rotting flesh, walking dead Jim Crow zombies of yore, and even the undead, lurching, worm-fed corpses of Nazi Germany, with clear eyes, is to be woke in post-racial America. I wanted to see it all for myself, I told her, so I wouldn't forget anything. And I wanted to see if I could help. All true. Is that cool with you? I asked. It is. She laughed and took her seat. I have truly never seen a community work so hard at meticulously and deliberately defining themselves for themselves as I did at the 200th anniversary celebration for the University of Virginia. With a unified voice, they took great care to say to the perpetuators of hatred, you do not get to define us. That is not who we are. And you know what? I believed him. It's a reckoning once again for America. A Saturn return. What are we going to shout in our loud and unified voice. Transition is an opportunity. Let's take the opportunity. Seriously.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Failing Up, written and performed by Leslie Odom Jr. Executive producers Laura Gatchko and Mike Charzik. Produced and directed by Chris Sacco. Edited by Brian Corcoran. Mixed and mastered by Brett Lubansky. Copyright 2018 by Leslie Odom Jr. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.